if we are prepared to go the route of using status confessionis as our stand in relationship to the nuclear arms race, you think we've been pushed to some points already. I think we're going to really be pushed to the edge. It will push us because of the claims that have been made in relationship to militarism. Okay, that's the place we have to start. To evaluate those kinds of claims, at this point now we can start to look at the definition of shalom. Because shalom, as I understand it, is part of a thread that runs through the scriptures. And there have been different words that have been used virtually interchangeably with the word shalom. And some of those words that are interchangeable are the words deliverance, salvation, wholeness, and there are others. That then we have to begin to look at what kinds of claims were made for human life on the basis of shalom, salvation, deliverance, etc. For some of this, I borrow on things that make for peace. The basic definition, an idiomatic definition of shalom is, do you have enough cash? Coming out of the social situation in which most Hebrew laborers were day laborers. They went to the marketplace in the morning. Think of the parable in the Gospels of the vineyard owner who went into the marketplace, hired people for the day. At sundown they were paid, they went home by the marketplace, bought whatever food was necessary for that night, and the next day we spent all of their money, and they and their family ate. Imagine then the situation of two Hebrew laborers at sundown exchanging that greeting, shalom. If they had their food in hand, the answer presumably would be yes, and you go home and eat. If one or the other of them had not worked that day, he obviously wasn't paid for that day's labor, and the answer would come back no, at which point the responsibility was placed squarely back on the community to ensure that shalom was again reestablished. Shalom was a covenant that held the community together, and in the Old Testament it was a blood covenant, a blood community. That group of people had that responsibility to each other, so that if any single member of the community was not at shalom, shalom had broken down in the entire community. If even the weakest member of the community was ill-fed, ill-clothed, ill-housed, whatever, shalom within that entire community had broken down. Some of the other ways in which that concept, shalom, deliverance, salvation, is talked about, the word reconciliation becomes a part of it. So that the narrowness of the community, as it was defined in the Old Testament, as the early church struggled with, it was also condemned, and it was no longer a community that was just made up of the circumcised. It was now a community that included the Jew and the Greek and the male and the female and the slave and the free. It was a broad community. Put that then, okay, and that was salvation. That was salvation. Salvation was justice. Salvation was reconciliation as an accomplished fact. Salvation presumably also included the ultimate relationship between humanity and God, because reconciliation there obviously was not just reconciliation between humans, but it was reconciliation also between humanity and God. So there is a sense in which salvation, shalom, deliverance, takes in every aspect of human life. Clearly, it's not something that waits until after a person has died. Now, take a look at those things that are promising salvation. Shalom, deliverance, wholeness. These days, those kinds of ultimate claims are being made for nuclear weaponry, and not just nuclear weaponry, there, you know, now all of a sudden we start getting into what will be the radical consequences of saying to ourselves, we stand over against nuclear weaponry in status confessiones, in causa confessiones. It brings us to a place where we must be prepared to grapple with the whole issue of nonviolence. You look at what is contained in Matthew 5 about turning the other cheek. It has heavy implications for us that I, in terms of my own peacemaking, have been dealing with in the paradox. We don't have time not to be patient. Yes, it's a critical time, but we don't have time not to be patient as we exercise our role as peacemakers. There are ultimate claims for salvation that are made in the name of national armies, armies that promise to protect us from the marauding hordes. And we will find ourselves rather face to face with the issue of loving the enemy if we place ourselves in a state of confession. We inescapably have to deal with what deterrence does. Deterrence promises peace. Deterrence promises shalom. It promises salvation. We have come to a place in which we have used the power of death to secure life. We have made a pact with death. We've come to a place where we say we can control death to such a degree that it will secure our lives. And that, I think, is probably the most ultimate of the claims that have been made for it. Again, I guess we're not always going to hear those kinds of words coming out of the mouth of Caspar Weinberger or Ronald Reagan, but the theological task is to point to the ultimate claims that are being made and call them what they are. As I was alluding to before, we have more than any other generation in human history harnessed the power of death, mega death, if you will. Unfortunately, it's not even just nuclear weapons. What happened in the Falklands was a prime example of the fact that we ought not just to be addressing the question of nuclear weapons. We ought to be addressing the questions of all weaponry. I mean, that was a frightful demonstration of what warfare has evolved into in the past 35 years. Something that we were just getting a taste of at the end of World War II with the firebombings. We have now, we not only engage in death, we engage in mega death. We are at a place where it will cause us, of necessity, to begin to work with a different definition of freedom. Freedom is not my choice to do anything that I want to. Freedom is not my choice to own anything that I want to. Freedom is not even my choice to go any place that I want to. Freedom is my choice to confess, or my ability to confess. And the reason I chose some of those knots, because freedom obviously cannot be taken away by putting someone in prison. Freedom cannot be taken away by making someone live under a different political regime. We will be looking at a very, very different kind of freedom, a very different definition of freedom. I'll talk some more about that tonight, but because I think those become part of the resistances that are in front of us on the basis of making a confession.
Dick, following that line of reasoning, though, it seems like everything that surrounds us, then we stand in confession again. Looking at the history of our country, people came to America with the claim that America was the land chosen by God, the promised land, that America would become the country that would save the world. So we stand against our country. And out of that comes the motto that freedom is peace. Freedom will bring us that peace. In the late 19th century, when the Industrial Revolution just began, out of the churches came the message that civilization and salvation went hand in hand. And that, so all of a sudden we stand in status confessionis against civilization. Then social gospel was developed, and part of that was to create a utopia. And so we stand in status confessionis against that. You know, why do we single out nuclear arms? If we follow that line of reasoning, we stand in whatever status confessionis against everything that surrounds us.
I think there's good cause to say that we must stand in a state of confession over against anything that is making claims of salvation. The hard part, again, about the theological task that's involved in that is saying which of those things are making ultimate claims and which of them are not. Because that's what it finally boils down to. And then the other part of it is, again, that it will be a decision that will be made differently by different individuals, some of whom... maybe part of the difficulty for us is that as a church that exists in the latter part of the 20th century in the United States, we have been afflicted, for better or for worse, by democratic process. The democratic process has brought us to the point where we've said that if a church in convention votes on something and a majority of the delegates say this is this, then it's the truth. A famous quotation from truth is not, it's determined by majority vote. We're dealing with something in which there will be no majority vote taken other than maybe a majority vote that probably is not a terribly significant one that says we recognize this to be a state of confession. What we're dealing with is something that I think there are a lot of religious traditions that would probably be better at it than we would, like Quakers and others that have been very comfortable throughout the course of history in responding to that quote-unquote inner light. That's where status confessionis begins.
I was going to say, a statement like this comes much closer to a statement of a peace church, complete pacifism, rather than a statement that would say war today and weapons of mass destruction have gotten to a point that there no longer can be a justifiable war. In other words, I find it difficult to say opposition to nuclear weapons is an issue of status confessionis. It seems like it would have to be against the idea of militarism in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these days I think that would have to be the approach. There may have been a time, I'm not sure I want to say it. I'll say it nonetheless. Let's check it out. There may have been a time when it would have been possible to say that simply in relationship to nuclear weapons. That may have been the appropriate thing to say in 1945. But because of where things have gone, because now, I guess I have a hunch that those same kinds of ultimate claims have always been made by armies. They're certainly being made at this point. That says there's ultimate salvation through military power.
Excuse me, you were telling us about all the different people and churches that are involved in your community. Are you opening up to a variety of churches the concept of status confessionis, or are you talking to us here as Lutherans or in Wisconsin? Are you talking to Lutherans about this? Are you talking to the Christian community?
I'm talking specifically as a Lutheran to Lutherans, mostly because... I personally have not had the opportunity to address it in that ecumenical context. Those who have been involved in it have approached it more on the basis of saying engaging in death to this degree is against it violates the command of God. not because it makes ultimate claims to salvation. That's language that's peculiar to us. Nobody else in the course of the history of religion has made those kinds of, has expressed salvation, if you will, in quite the same kinds of words of saying, you know, salvation is given to humanity by the grace of God, without human intervention. So it's on that basis that we, I guess, are the peculiar ones, if you will, in being able to say that.
I have one more question. Would making this kind of statement about militarism, would that, in effect, be in opposition to Article 16 of the Augsburg Confession that says Christians may without sin licitly wage war?
Just war.
Just
war. There you get into the argument about what's a just war, and we're back again at a different place where there is that place for legitimate disagreement. And when you start, you know, using the 7 or 8 criterion for a just war, you're always making a judgment on an event that's happening, you know, on a particular war or something in advance, in this case in relationship to nuclear war. And I think we can very easily use the just war theory to say nuclear war just doesn't meet those standards anymore. But again, we are doing a very different thing if we want to say state of confession.
I'd like to interrupt because we're almost out of time.
Yes.
Would you be willing to come back? We're scheduled back at 8 o'clock. Would you be willing to come back at 7:30 and see if we can gather together in some form what we've learned and heard for the last hour and a half?
I don't know when they're going to announce Vespers. The community Vespers will be in here. You all could meet somewhere else during that time if you wish.
It would be before that, you think?
Well, it'll either be 7 or 7:30. It'll either be 7 and then a break between the end of the session, or 7:30 and then a very brief. Vespers is 20 minutes long. So
And we alternate on Vespers. If it's 7:30, yeah, we'll meet at 7. Is that all right?
We can
just whoever would like to do that. I'd like to do that.
Okay. I would like to also.
Okay.
As you may be able to tell, I came here not to convince you of the fact that this is a state of confession. I came rather to lay out what lies in front of us, and I would appreciate some more conversation about that, because for me also it is still a very open question. I guess I need to say something about what we're going to do tonight too, so that you or whoever does it can announce it at supper. The place that I'd like to go with it tonight is to say, okay, we've arrived at the end of the tunnel. We've already made a decision one way or another. Either it's a matter of confession or it's contrary to the command of God. Now what do we do with it? So I'll address it from the point of view of saying peacemaking, hope, and witness.
Let me ask a very kind of practical question. You that have been here, I don't think the Holden community would want, because they could come at 8 o'clock. I don't think they'd want to stop a process if that's going to be so difficult as you teach, knowing that there may be 20 people who didn't hear any of this to go on with it. Then I think maybe the agenda ought to be to continue and not necessarily say it's an open session, or say they can come but they're halfway through it or something. I have a funny feel about a separate session at 8 o'clock.
Well, it's not separate from it.
But I mean, I have a funny feel about 20 people who didn't hear this starting at 8 o'clock without you constantly saying, and then having to come back and repeat some hour and a half of groundwork. Am I the only one that...
I do not feel complete with this discussion.
Yeah.
And whether it takes 20 minutes to conclude or whether we pick up at 8 o'clock, I would like to see us complete it before moving on.
Okay.
Hear that, and if not as group, you know, as a group, at least privately.
Okay.
Maybe all I'm asking is how we announce that it's open, but some explanation that it isn't a separate presentation, that it's a continuation of this afternoon or something. I don't want to discourage them from coming, but I...
Let me say a little bit more about what I'm going to do tonight.
Okay.
Peacemaking, hope, and witness. You may have remembered, what we were talking about this afternoon was peacemaking, confession, and witness. What I want to get to tonight is the fact that no matter how you arrive at it, there is an injunction in this case, in Article 10, that says resistance is necessary. If you don't take it from there, you take it from the place that in the book of Acts, I must obey God rather than humanity. You get to the place of resistance. How do you do that? As a way of witness, as well as a way of communicating hope. If that seems like we're trying to move too fast, too far, because we haven't resolved the issue of status confessionis, I'm willing to stay with that. If it seems to be
a suggestion procedurally for tonight, let us gather on one side or the other of Vespers and see if we can clarify what we've heard.
Well, I will make a stab at it, and then you will fill in all the gaps and correct all the misstatements. Just one thing about the group dynamic. It seemed to me we were coming pretty hard at the in statu confessionis as presented by Dick, because we had higher hopes for a more specific and thorough theological focus than he was willing to allow us to have. And so there was some frustration and maybe even aggression at some points in our expressions. That's all right. We can do that. We're friends. It sounded to me as though Dick was saying that there is something called in causa confessionis, which says something stands over against the confession of the church according to some specifics that he has listed. That something is considered an adiaphorum, and whatever else he has up there. We heard that this afternoon. When that is in fact the case, persons who perceive that individually and or corporately can declare themselves to be in a state of confession, which means they are in faithfulness to the confessions, which we may presume mean the gospel, our understanding of it, in faithfulness to that, then they become a point of resistance, a spokesman in opposition to whatever that is. Dan?
One thing I thought of that might clarify something is our problem with adiaphora. It's helpful to me to think that we who have been involved in the peace movement have a hard time seeing war making as adiaphora, but it is, for as far as the traditional Lutheran stance, whether or not a person chooses to be in a war or not in a war is a adiaphora, and the church supports the individual conscience. For us who have been involved in the peace movement, that seems awfully strange to say. And I think at least I found myself reacting to that you could sit there and say war is adiaphora. And then when I thought it through, yes, it is. And it's reached such a magnitude of, or such a horrible state that it's offensive for us, I think, too. So that clarified a little for me. But still it is.
Because that designation is in relationship to the statement of soteriology of the church. Hmm. And we're coming at it from a different point of view.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to ask.
Okay. Another thing that I heard from Dick in part of his presentation was that if we stand in confession, make a stand in confession, that confession, well, he's already got it up there, cannot be a strategy or tactic to support our point of view. And at the same time, once we make that confession, it cannot, we cannot move from that into strategizing and developing tactics as how we put this confession into action. That the confession in and of itself, confession in and of itself is enough at that point.
That's not exactly what I was saying. I guess I would say my confession will lead me to action, but my confession will not lead somebody else to action. Their confession is going to have to do that for them.
Mm-hmm. So there can be action.
Yeah, as it says there in that article in the Formula of Concord, it's a necessity. Those who, it says every Christian, but it places the special burden on the ministers, as it says in there, to be the leaders of the resistance.
Question that I used historically, and I just want to clarify. Did Dietrich Bonhoeffer and the Confessing Church go back to this, or was that a different phrase that's similar, but not technically in causa confessione?
Right. They did not use that. In fact, as far as I can tell, the first time it was used was in relationship to South Africa.
Okay.
They called themselves the Confessing Church, obviously, and I guess I see them having done that on the basis of opposing the rest of the church in Germany, which had lost touch. So they probably would have had just cause for using this as their rational or their justification, their motivation, because they certainly were over against the rest of the church at that point.
The question that I have that kind of short circuits the current discussion, so if you don't want to deal with it, we don't have to, is if we decide that the issue of nuclear arms or militarism is indeed a matter for us to stand in a state of confession, it is not, because it's not a strategy and it's not a tactic, there's nothing to gain by it. It's not something we do in order to gain something. So that, in other words, by doing this, you gain nothing.
In the traditional sense of the word, as I said, we must temporarily put aside our concerns for effectiveness and pragmatism and all that kind of stuff. As we were leaving here, we were talking, and I said, as I would envision it, what happens is that there are some people who decide that they are in a state of confession over against nuclear weapons, and they start doing something about it. And what happens when somebody does something like that is they get out there in the front lines, and they get caught in a meat grinder, and there's a lot of blood that gets let. And then sometime thereafter, somebody says, "Oh, here were some people who became martyrs for the gospel." Other kinds of things like that, and it's recognized in retrospect. The effectiveness then, if you will, is in people who have taken the risk of confessing and acting on the basis of their confession, which is a very different measure of success or effectiveness.
And the discussion, in our discussion around the technically correct understanding of instanti confessionis, really has neither stopped anyone nor encourages anyone from making a confession, a statement of confession, and being, in essence, coming out at the point where one would come out if they were instanti confessionis, and indeed, if one did place themselves in that position, most of our time would be spent explaining to other people what it meant for us to be in that position.
That's right. I think that's been the confusion in relationship to South Africa. We've engaged in tactics. We haven't done the explanation of of what that action meant.
That becomes a question of logistics in part.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't do what Mary's question earlier had to do with the relationship of this to doctrinal or confessional equality, and it doesn't have anything to do with that. The LWF action does not in any way make the South African status confessionis binding upon. It's an affirmation of what is there, and it's not a doctrine. It doesn't become that kind of issue for us.
Simply because that would be going entirely contrary to the basis on which we're talking. The central doctrine, and I've in the last couple of years suddenly begun to understand what some seminary professors were trying to say 10 years ago. The central doctrine, in fact, the only doctrine that the Lutheran Church has is one that says we are saved by grace. And the other things are would technically not fit as doctrines. So if you raise something else up to this doctrinal status, you've now said there's an alternative way to be saved.
Well, when you answered him, I got the feeling that you thought it was too bad that people had been engaging in the action rather than explaining why they were engaging in the action. I understood you to say better to get on with the action than spend a lot of extra time explaining it to people. I'm not sure if I understood you.
I guess what I was saying is if we decided to do that, since we did, we should have spent at least as much time talking about what we had done and why we chose to say this is a matter, that this is a something that is a state of confession, rather than immediately going to talk about tactics. That wasn't the purpose of the original declaration, I don't think. At this point, I think we need to be doing both. We need to be acting, and somewhere along the line explaining where our salvation is, too. That would go a long way towards addressing a lot of issues.
What would you see as a... I know you're not supposed to think of it in terms of tactics or strategy or anything else.
That's okay.
What would be the impact if there was a growing group of persons in the United States that indicated that they found themselves in a state of confession with regard to nuclear weaponry? Simply made that statement, and that's all they did with it. They didn't ask the church to pass on it, they didn't do anything else with it.
Recognizing that we're speculating, let me tell a story that I think can illustrate it quite well. Another situation from South Africa. Because of the racial imbalance there and the fact that whites are outnumbered by blacks 18-1 or something like that, the white army in South Africa is constantly charged with the task of maintaining order, border patrols as well as internal order. Because there's that vast need for army to keep order, every white in South Africa must, of necessity, serve 3 years in the army. Jehovah's Witnesses in South Africa, by their religious commitments and convictions, will not serve in the army. They just absolutely refuse. But there's no provision in South African law for conscientious objectors. So they're automatically put in jail. No questions asked. They just spend a couple of years in jail. However, in the last 3 years, there have been 5 white South Africans, not Jehovah's Witnesses, who have declared themselves to be conscientious objectors. They, too, have been put in jail. There are approximately 30,000 people inducted into the army each year. So those 5 people over the course of 3 years are a very, very small number in relationship to the rest of the army. But because there have been 5 people who have stood over against the power structure there, who have refused induction into the army, have been imprisoned, most of them being very, very eloquent and saying that they're doing it on the basis of religious convictions, the South African Parliament is now in the process of defining alternative service. It's a first step. I think we underestimate the power that there is in an individual standing and acting upon their convictions, especially their strongly held convictions.
That could apply to any form of peace activity. It could engage something that means, you know, breaking the law.
Mm-hmm. I think actually John Limnitzer's recent acquittal of trespass charges were on the basis of religious conviction about the imminent threat of nuclear arms, not whether or not he trespassed.
Right.
So is that kind of case?
Yes.
But I'm wondering, like, you know, again, whether it's there, I can't help but keep coming back to the actual question. Whether
yes.
it's simply worth it or not to try to use this particular historical understanding to try to give expression to basically what we feel really does lie behind it. That in fact what is occurring is a form of idolatry, which is very very much along the line of what Dan did with his paper, with his corpus. Or whether it simply would not be better to make that case alone by itself.
I guess my feeling at this point is that because, well, here we're getting way off the subject, but you know, we're basically talking about what has been the proclamation of the Church in recent years. The proclamation of the Church has not always been a theology of the cross. It's been a theology of glory. And a theology of glory doesn't leave very much room for people getting chewed up in meat grinders. We're going to have to be a lot more eloquent and careful about proclaiming our theology of the cross. I guess I would assume that's probably why the authors of the formula said that it's the leaders of the Church's primary responsibility to be the leaders of the resistance. Because they, of all people, should be the ones who know that, and at the same time ought to be proclaiming that message from their pulpits and in their actions and all of that, but they're going to be the ones leading the way.
Mary?
But part of my understanding of theology of the cross is that it probably isn't going to be successful. And I think if this group starts out by thinking in any way that we're going to be successful, isn't the point, even when you said, but in retrospect, that they'll look back and say, aha, there was a group of people. I mean, they might not, and that's kind of all right, because
sure.
we say
sure.
so much of holding, as long as we're faithful, God takes care of the results. And even to say, oh, but there's great power in that, you know, I'd like to say, but that kind of smacks the theology of glory again. I mean, maybe we'll just fall flat on our
mm-hmm.
face, but if it's
mm-hmm.
something that we feel strongly about,
There are a couple of things going on there at the same time. Because there have been those, what we would call, positive results, it's possible to look back at those five people in South Africa and say they had an effect. They, unfortunately, were people who went through the meat grinder, first of all. There's a sense in which truth... I've been influenced a great deal by Gandhi of late, you know, the power of truth, which is a very different kind of power, begins to shape things in a different way. I guess I don't see that as being incompatible with saying at the same time that's not a tactic.
It seems to me, I'm a process person and you know that, and you can change me, or force me to go along with this sometime. It seems to me we have to wrestle with a question about what we do and how we do it. This presents a possibility in the way that it has been explained to us, or we can perhaps seek our focus, a theological focus, in the first and fifth commandments, which generally we have been doing anyway, but maybe not specifically. Part of my concern is strategy and tactics. I want to deal with that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you're leaving me out, see, I don't like that. I don't know how the rest of you would feel, but I think we need to find out.
Well, at dinner, I was like, a fellow with a dinner were wondering whether to go this route would cut us off from a real sense of relating to all the rest of the groups, Christian and non-Christian, in the world today, who are, I know you're saying you don't think of that when you decide. Okay. We did think of it, you know, we were supposed to.
let me say something about it again. It's easy to get seduced into that, to think, how am I going to turn somebody else around? And this one is speaking to me.
Mm-hmm.
It says, what am I going to do about it? And it doesn't preclude strategizing.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm saying this will not allow itself to be used as a strategy. So it says, this speaks to each of us as individuals and says, how am I going to go about making my confession? Which is a different question from saying, okay, I have made a confession. Now how can I help other people make their confession too?
Mm-hmm.
But this one will not allow itself, I don't think, to be used as a way of working somebody else into a place where they can make their confession.
And I wasn't wanting to use it for that one. I was just wondering if it would cut me off from other people who had who were moving in the same direction.
I think it would, yes.
And I think right off the top of my head that would be too bad.
It would, right. And that's part of the reason I would not want to use it, because there are some people who think about it and act on it in a distinctly different way than I do, whose motivation is different. And I think I can work with those people. That's not where the compromise takes place. You know, that it's okay to compromise in that kind of situation.
So there are two things that can happen with that. I can say I'm in a state of confession about this issue over against the government, and maybe in some instances over against the church.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is an action similar to that that LWM took, to say, we recognize this as a legitimate kind of thing for those who want to do it. And that would, to do the second thing, would be to set ourselves up over against, it seems to me, a lot of other Christian groups working on this.
Mm-hmm.
To do the first is simply, as you mentioned, that probably the thing that's intended in the first place, simply to make an individual decision.
And it probably is not going to stop me from advocating passionately for my point of view on things. But again, it's nothing more than that. The difference in what we were saying there about the LWF action, they did not declare it to be a state of confession. They recognized that one existed. And those are two distinctly different.